I think it goes without saying what's going on by this point in time, and if there are any explanations needed, I don't know what to tell you anymore. We're now on page 134, and we're going to limp through page 145 in the fourth section.
And we're going to continue...
Brief multi-day hiatus.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, we emptied the tank on the Bonsai Art of Kimura 2 nights ago.
Yep.
By the last 3 trees, we were pretty much... We were just like, whatever.
Yeah. We maybe didn't do those justice, but it's okay. I think we've been powering through this thing. This has been a real marathon, and but I think this is really great to get some background.
It's all your fault. This is your idea.
You're right.
So just to give you guys context, Will said you were going to talk about the book, but then you only talked about one tree. And I thought we could go through it page by page. And now 5 hours later.
I guess literally. I guess I didn't realize how big this book was. It's been a little while since I've looked through it.
You just didn't realize how much context there was for each tree. There's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot
in here.
Yeah.
This, if you choose to break down Mr. Kimura's work with any level of detail and in sort of historical references and intelligent discussion of the design and whatnot, his bonsai approach is quite deep. It's very, very deep.
Yeah.
And so not many people, I'm glad that you wanted to do this, because there's a lot of stuff in here that I'm looking at that I haven't looked at in this way in a long time. And I think you always hope, well, I would think that as someone putting this kind of effort into their trees, that they would always hope somebody would really look at it and appreciate it on a level just beyond like, oh, that looks really cool.
Yeah.
You know? So in a lot of ways, it's very respectful, I think, to look at it in this way. So I've enjoyed it thus far.
Good. Yeah, me too. We're on page 134 and 135. This is the number one, Pinus thunbergiana.
Thunbergiana.
This is a really great tree. I love the flaky bark.
I wonder what. That's interesting. Thunbergiana. Isn't it thunbergii?
Yeah, I thought it was.
Yeah, Pinus thunbergiana. Maybe that's changed. Should we just Google that real quick?
It's thunbergii with 2 eyes.
Yeah, it's thunbergii. That's interesting. Maybe the name changed.
So this is what he did here is what you teach us a lot about feminine form trees, which is that you generally want to narrow the design and add negative space, and what a dramatic effect to take off the number one branch completely and just have this piece of gin. I really like what he's done here, and you see more of the trunk with the new style than you did on the old one. It just shows off the trunk way more. And it shows off that bark.
We're going to have to edit this first section pretty heavily until we get into it.
I think this will be part 3 of this. Mm-hmm. I think we're in our 4th or 5th hour on this.
Let's start over.
It's okay. It's okay. You can make fun of me.
No, I'm not making fun of you at all. I'm making fun of us. We're all just like. I feel the same way, man. I feel the exact same way.
Yeah, we've had a big marathon week. This is a marathon week for bonsai for us. And we've been doing this marathon podcast. So yeah, we're nearing the end.
Yeah. Let's start one more time.
Okay.
You ready? All right. Well, we're back for part 2 of the breakdown of the Bonsai Art of Kimura. And by the end of the last session, this has been Will's idea to go through this book page by page, which has been quite enjoyable. I haven't looked at this book in this depth in a long time. And I think it's very respectful to take the time to sort of appreciate and analyze and try to dive deeper into the work of somebody who's dedicated their life to bonsai, as Mr. Kimura has, and broken so much new ground.
Yeah,
I mean, he really, absolutely. Really redefined the approach to bonsai design in a lot of ways. I mean, he didn't create bonsai, but he conceptualized bonsai in a way people hadn't up to that point in the art of bonsai and the world of bonsai as it existed in Japan. And this book influenced bonsai outside of Japan probably more than bonsai inside of Japan, I would think.
Probably.
Because this was sort of the crown jewel of inspiration and reference for all of us.
And in intentional design. You really see how he approaches designing these trees with intention.
Absolutely. So we pick back up on page
134.
134 and 135, and a beautiful Japanese black pine. And Will, you kind of made note of something before we started recording, but do you want to go back to sort of your analysis of the changes that he made?
I mean, so Ryan's always taught us that with feminine form trees, you want to narrow the silhouette and maximize negative space and elongate generally the feminine form.
Mm-hmm.
And he really, this is just a classic narrow and elongate while adding negative space refinement for this thing and restyle. By taking that number one branch off, he opens up a tremendous amount of negative space between the foliage and the pot and just frames in that little gin right there. It's just, I love it. And I love that he's exposed the trunk more.
Mm-hmm.
The trunk is really the defining characteristic and the main feature of this tree.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, when you look at page 134, that defining branch on that tree is the defining branch of a very masculine, powerful pine. And the trunk of this tree is not masculine and it's not powerful. And that branch, no matter how you treat that branch, it would be very, very difficult to use that branch for the trunk that's actually holding it. So,
yeah,
heavy. To a large degree, the intuition to remove that branch, that's a tough branch to cut off.
Yeah.
Because there's so much on it. But as far as just objectively analyzing the design of the tree, it was the move to make to really make this tree elegant and take advantage of the really slender, beautiful trunk with a lot of dramatic, not dramatic, but a lot of really subtle movement in the trunk. But I think there's another aspect of this that stands out to me, and that is the fact that the branch on the left actually has a really interesting movement and character to it. It goes out to the left from the trunk, it goes up, and then comes back down.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a incredible pine branch, really unique, really natural branch that happened outside of the dictatorial control of the bonsai practitioner, right? Wherever this material started from, that's definitely a remnant of a piece of Yamadori. It wasn't intent. I doubt anybody would ever intentionally create a branch like that. Some people might, mm-hmm. but not many.
And it's interesting. You see in page 134 that there's just the hint of that gin hanging out the back. So I guess what he did is he used that guy wire to pull it into the trunk. Is that what you think he did?
Yeah, you're correct.
Yeah, pulled it up.
He actually pulled it up.
Pulled it up with that.
Yeah, wow, okay.
And tighten
and
that
maybe
pad.
And maybe that's...
Oh, you are correct. You are correct.
Looks like it rotated the pad counterclockwise.
Yeah, he actually did. He created that verticality. Oh, fascinating. Wow.
Pretty cool.
There you go. I stand corrected. Mr. Kimura created that branch. Huh. That's pretty wild. Now, there's another thing to take from this tree, too, when you talk about... If you look at 134 and you look at where the branch on the left intersects the trunk, you see the bottom 30% of the trunk, which for a masculine tree, this is very, very sort of standard approach to design. Mm-hmm. You don't show the totality of the trunk line. But in eliminating that big defining branch on the right and pulling that branch on the left in vertically, as Will pointed out, which is a keen observation. That's pretty amazing that he did that. But in doing so, he's sort of just letting the needles sort of touch the interior bend of that. But you see mm-hmm. the trunk line exposed all the way up to the apex. And typically you would say the more feminine a tree gets, the more of the trunk that you expose and the more of the length of the structural branches that you would expose. And you notice in the upper canopy, you see a lot of the structural branches as they descend down into the pads. You even see all of the movement up in the canopy up to the apical region.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at 134, a lot of that is hidden. There's a lot of long branches.
Yep.
You can't see the origin of a lot of those structural branches. It's disguised by foliage.
The upper canopy is really broad for that narrow of a trunk on 134.
Yeah. But again, I don't know that a lot of people would think to take this tree by cutting off that first branch on the right. It sort of guides the process of now reducing all of the branches throughout the upper canopy of the tree. And you see what it does, and seeing it, it's like, oh yeah, okay. But then putting yourself in the position of, would I have made those decisions with that tree? That becomes sort of that next question, right?
Yeah.
And being able to have a tree carrying the concepts forward that we're discussing in this book and really being able to see that yourself
is hard
and make those decisions yourself, that's tough. And that's ultimately, you know, when I'm teaching students and I'm teaching you guys design, sometimes, and I don't know, I always wondered this when I was studying with Mr. Kimura, is he doing this because he sees it, or is he using his knowledge of design to guide that process? Because you could have the sense to do that, but also you could look at it and say, well, this is a slender trunk and this is a very masculine form and style that's been applied to it. And this is how you reduce a masculine style to give it more elegance and more delicacy, reducing the width, elongating the design, opening up negative space, creating branch pads that are more proportional to an elegant design and not a masculine design. Just that knowledge alone can guide those decisions to improve a tree when you identify this is a slender feminine trunk,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily matter so much if you can see it, because the concepts themselves of how a great feminine design is executed versus a great masculine design is executed can give you the insight. Even if you're looking at the tree on 134 and you say, there's something not quite right here, and you just start to basically ask that basic question, is this yep. masculine or is this feminine in terms of the material? Is this masculine or is this feminine in terms of the design? If there is not continuity in the answer to those two questions, then there has to be changes made. And the changes made are then what makes a good feminine design? Narrow silhouette, elongated yep. design, more negative space, right? Smaller branch pads, smaller apex. All of a sudden, you already have sort of your guideposts to the changes you could make that would improve and highlight that elegance and feminine nature of the trunk. And that's pretty cool to understand that aesthetic. And there's a lot of times where aesthetic decisions, because there's so much visual information from a tree, you really do have to lean on the concepts to help guide just the initiation of the process.
Yeah.
And I find that to be quite fascinating.
You know, I and maybe like many people didn't understand feminine form trees
mm-hmm.
until I started studying with you.
Mm.
I didn't know how to approach a tree with a narrow profile like that.
Right.
And I think a lot of people out there just compact, compact, compact.
Yep.
Right. It's all they know. And to be able to elongate a tree is a next step in bonsai progress in terms of your design thinking. So
I totally agree.
to be able to maximize a feminine form bonsai by elongating, narrowing, and adding negative space. And like you said, showing the trunk almost to the very top of the tree, yep. Showing off the trunk.
Showing really. More of the structural branches, showing smaller branch paths.
Mm-hmm.
And that trickles down into the container as well. You know, a more shallow container, just in general, a smaller container
yeah.
starts to accentuate those same characteristics in a really big way. I feel like the compaction model and the way that we've looked at bonsai in the Western world to a large degree, the desire to get a tree to back bud so that we have buds in tight. I hear a lot of people saying, take for example, Hinoki cypress, a piece of nursery stock Hinoki cypress.
Mm-hmm.
Hinoki cypress don't back bud. I'm going to chop the trunk in half and I'm going to try to get these branches to bud on the interior and then I'll have a tree. And it's like, well, but Hinoki cypress inherently is a more elegant tree. I mean, you can find a really powerful Hinoki cypress, but you're going to find one out of 50 Hinoki cypress that's powerful, and you're going to find 49 of them that lend themselves towards an elegant design.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, if you try to treat those 49 trees like a powerful tree, you're not going to be utilizing the material correctly at all. And elongating that and using the length and using the elegance is actually how 49 of the 50 trees should have been styled, or what the material was giving you the opportunity to pursue.
Yep.
And that has been, I think, a design concept that's largely not been taught or has been missed by a lot of people, trying to sort of stuff each piece of material into the same conformity and application of technique and design concept. Mm-hmm. And when we look at our Yamadori that we have in North America, and even I think throughout Europe, a lot of Yamadori is inherently delicate and feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And so seeing that and trying to compress all of these trees that are inherently feminine and compact is so counterintuitive to what they're actually offering us.
Yeah.
And this tree is just a prime example of that application, recognition of the material and what it has to offer, and the execution of that to create something really spectacular. This is my number two tree in the book.
Cool.
My number one was the juniper in the Rinka pot. This is number two for me. I find this tree to just be absolutely stunning. Absolutely stunning. Mm-hmm. I think it's magical.
Great pot too. Nanban.
Yeah, Nanban. I mean, I think the pot is even a little bit heavy for it. The walls are fairly straight. Mm-hmm. There's most Nanban have a significant contact point. They don't have feet. So that doesn't bother me so much, but the tree does feel rather, or the container does feel rather bulky. The really thick rim,
mm-hmm.
I think, does touch in on the ruggedness of the bark, because there is like a stronger feeling elegant tree being a black pine. Yeah. They're never going to be as elegant and as delicate as like a really elegant red pine. It's just not going to happen.
Sure.
But I think even more angle to the wall, a little bit less depth, would make the container feel even more congruent with the elegance that he's brought about in the design. And then I think beyond that, again, just going back to the discussion of the round and the apex breaking the lateral boundary would feel really, really nice. You can't call this isn't a literati design. This isn't a Bunjin tree at all. It's a very feminine, informal, upright tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wonder what an ovular pot would look like underneath this, because I think it would need to be a shallow, smaller oval pot, but I think it would look really maybe a little bit more appealing than the round,
because it's a pretty
the apex is
straight
almost
up and down
yeah
tree
the apex
as far
is almost
as,
over the base yep. of the tree. It doesn't really have the lateral movement to justify the round container, but even inside of Mr. Kimura's early work, because these are all pieces of work from the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
I studied with Mr. Kimura from 2004 to 2010. His sense of containers and sort of he's breaking the box with his design concepts in terms of the tree, but you can see that throughout a lot of this book, the aesthetics with the containers is not something that's as evolved.
Yeah.
And I think that always has to come second. You have to be able to design a tree to then understand the nuances of ceramics. Like, you have to kind of really not master the design of the tree, but you have to have a fluency in terms of the design dialogue with the tree itself to be able to then go back and critically look at ceramics and how you can elevate that material even a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I think his design aesthetic around ceramics continued to evolve after this book, obviously. I mean, his design work with trees did as well. I mean, this is his jumping off point here, yep, because this is still very young in his career. But I definitely saw his container selection from looking at these pieces to what I know of his container selection change over the course of time and mature. And so it's pretty, it's a fascinating flashback, yeah, to see where he was at this point.
Early thinking, sure. Yeah.
And even with somebody who's as innovative as Mr. Kimura, to look back at this book and see a lot of brilliant things created in this book early in his career, you still recognize that his brilliance, again, we talked about it earlier, is very raw at this point with, mm-hmm, Matsunaga-san and Yajima-san and Kawabe-san as his apprentices. And he continued to refine that approach both in the design of the tree, but also with the use of ceramics. And that's a beautiful thing to recognize about the whole thing.
Okay.
Page 136 cool and 137.
Wow. Cascading style, chinensis.
This one's a monster.
Yeah, this is still looks in his like garden. A big tree.
This tree is still in his garden.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great deadwood. Look at the live vein. How it snakes around and then, wow.
So that live vein is what makes this tree.
Yep.
It's what makes this tree special. Now there's an interesting discussion around this tree, because this particular piece has been grafted over with shimpaku.
Okay.
But the shimpaku that's grafted on it is two different varieties of shimpaku.
Really?
So the apex of the tree is a different variety than the rest of the tree.
Why is that?
Well, you know how at Mirai sometimes when we're grafting, the grafting stock looks the same over real anemic, yeah, in the grafting yard, because we keep, when you approach graft with junipers, you want to keep the whips very slender. You don't want them to thicken. So you don't fertilize them. You put them in a really tiny container and you're trying to keep them as thin as possible so that they stay as viable of grafting stock for as long as possible.
Hmm.
Because the thicker that they get, the harder it is. It's harder to graft a really thick piece of grafting stock onto a really thick branch. You typically are grafting on thumb size or less.
Yeah.
Right. And a thumb size piece would even be the bigger size, maybe an index finger size or a pinky finger size branch is what you're grafting to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it only takes shimpaku 1 or 2 years to thicken beyond that girth if you start fertilizing it. So if you have Itoigawa, you have Kishu, you have Toyama, you've got 3 or 4 different varieties, and in Mr. Kramer's garden, he had maybe 5 varieties of shimpaku, whether some of them were for root grafting because they produce roots prolifically, or some were for larger trees like the Toyama, because when I was studying with him, he wasn't grafting Itoigawa to everything. He was still trying to proportionally graft a foliar type that fit the size and scale of the tree.
Yeah.
And then Kishu and Itoigawa were either for smaller trees, or he didn't actually graft Kishu onto juniper. In Japan, that's considered an inferior variety of shimpaku. Oh. He used it for root grafting because of the bluish color and slightly coarser foliage type. So we had all of these, but they all looked the same. And if they got mixed up, when you took the, because we would air layer off of a larger mother stock plant, mm-hmm, to create the grafting stocks. It's the same way I produce our grafting stock at Mirai.
Mm-hmm.
We've got mother stock plants in the garden. We go and we air layer 60 air layers off of it, and now that's our grafting stock for 3 or 4 years.
Yep.
Well, if that gets mixed together with everything and they get very anemic because you're not fertilizing them, then they all look the same. And so the upper canopy of the tree is totally different. Juniper stock than the lower branches, and you don't know until it really starts to mature.
Yeah.
So like we did a stream on a grafted Rocky Mountain juniper, that we did the live vein and deadwood work on as well. And the apex of that tree is a different foliage than the rest of the tree.
So, I mean, you can probably notice it, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, because the apex is blue and the rest of the tree is green. I mean, it's very apparent right now. Like, I walk out into the garden and I'm just like, dang it, dang it. And the funny thing is it matured so much over the course of time that it becomes hard for Mr. Kimura and this particular cascading juniper. It's sitting in a beautiful square pot, yeah, with cut corners and an inset square. It's not the pot that it's in now. It's in a far higher quality pot now, okay, than in this photograph. But the apical region matured so much that it becomes hard to then graft on to this like really refined apical region when the rest of the tree is so mature. It's got a lot of mochikomi. I mean, all the branches have virtually no wire on them, you know? So you think like, okay, I'm going to go redo half of the tree when the other tree is this established form and age.
Sure.
It might be tough to get them. It could be done, but it would be tough to ever get them to the same level of maturity now that there's such a gap if you were to regraft. So it's just stayed the same.
Yeah.
And they're both, I guess, close enough green that maybe most people don't notice it.
Yeah.
But it's pretty apparent. Like if you look at in any sort of, with a critical eye, you're going to see, there's two different junipers on here. Now, the mistake that I made on the one in the garden, it's really, really obvious because it's blue and green.
Yeah.
And I will, this year, I'll go back and I'll scion graft the graft. So I'm not going to reapproach graft the thing because I already put the first approach graft on the best location and the Rocky Mountain juniper has now been removed from it. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have to scion graft from the Kishu stock that I have to mesh the two so that it's all Kishu.
Yep.
Hilarious though.
Ugh, what a pain in the butt.
And it's funny because as apprentices, you do find those moments where there's been like a, to some degree, a little bit of a failure, like, oh, he grafted two different, you know, kind of unnecessary, but you kind of have those small victories where you see a mistake because, you know, when you're an apprentice, your master is perfection almost, what they're doing. And so to see that.
When you find a mistake, you can.
Yeah, you find a little bit of humanity.
Sure.
Human again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's now been brought back down to earth for that moment.
For that moment.
Yeah. But it is pretty funny that the apex of this tree and the lower branches are two different junipers, and lo and behold, the apex and lower branches of the Rocky Mountain juniper I grafted are two different junipers. It's pretty hilarious. Yeah, yeah. Anyways, this is stunning. And the movement of that live vein across the front connects to the apex, directly connects to the apex, and is the most prominent feature of this tree. You could not lose that live vein and have this tree hold the same value because it is the live vein that gives so much movement and interaction between the live and the dead. Comes from the back, circles around the dead wood, twists around. This tree has always been in Mr. Kramer's garden. I do believe it's his. I don't know that for sure. But it is a prominent piece. It is a very powerful tree to stand in front of. And it's big. Big tree. It's not small.
On these cascades, is it pretty common to have the trunk originate out of so far off the side of the pot?
Yeah, to the right there. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I would say it's not. And the way that it's in, that's another thing that I've been noticing in this book is how offset a lot of the trees are. Yeah. A lot of the cascades particularly are offset.
But very.
You have to keep in mind that this is probably the first potting from the collected box. And if you look on page 136,
it's also in that position.
It's offset dramatically. Now, maybe it's offset because that's how they were able to get the trunk to hang off the edge of the box. But it may also be offset because the tree was growing in a pocket in the mountains. And there's a prominent root that extends that pushed it. And this is as far as he could reduce it the first time safely.
Mm-hmm.
And so where it sits now, it's elevated a little higher in the container. The live vein that exists outside of the rim of the container is actually elevated a little bit higher and sits inside of the rim, not touching the rim, but up over the rim of the pot that it's in now. And it's centered and it's in the pot that it lives in now. It's quite a okay. bit smaller pot now yeah. than this particular. So I'm guessing this is sort of first iteration and it's been improved upon. As we see, I mean, we repotted that Utah juniper today and it took on an entirely different shape, form, position in the container, etc. If you looked at the first position as that dramatic cascade offset all the way to the front of the pot, mm-hmm. today we changed it entirely. Now it's in the center of the pot and it's a totally different form. Same process is going to apply to this tree.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
Just continual improvements as they evolve. Yeah, that one's a monster though. And the acute angle of drop, I mean, you see the negative space
yep.
between the trunk and the dropping portion. It's an acute angle. I mean, these concepts are continually reinforced.
And this is a full cascade or?
Yeah, it's full cascade.
Okay, because the foliage does not necessarily break the pot, but the dead wood does, so.
I mean, I would say the foliage just probably barely goes beneath the
yeah.
rim of the pot. But I mean, God, so because semi-cascade and cascade, once you drop below the rim, they both warrant the same style of container.
Yeah.
For the most part. And so then when it goes into a full cascade, I don't know how many people are out there like, well, let's see. Let's get out the ruler. Is that actually a yeah. cascade or not? You know, like... cut off the feet and all of a sudden it is. I mean, it's yeah. it's a cascading tree for yep, sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. 138 and 139.
Okay.
Another rigida.
Mm-hmm. Formal upright. Love the relief in the trunk, dead wood in the trunk. And maybe, you know, you weren't as big of a fan of that in earlier trees, but I feel like it really helps make this tree look old.
Yeah, I mean, I think he executed a lot of. Actually, I'm gonna take that back. There's not a lot of in and out movement in the silhouette. He's got a rather triangular form. I'm gonna say I don't find this tree to be very appealing at all. Actually, if I'm just being honest,
mm-hmm.
this is one of the more symmetrical sort of It's not a phenomenal piece of material.
Mm-hmm.
He's taking humble material and he's designing it. And again, this is first iteration, and I'm sure this tree now has a considerably different form. But I don't think there's a whole lot of merit to talk about the shape as it is a very young shape, and it's a very young iteration of the tree. But I do think the shift, this is where the shift from a round container in a tree that exists inside of the boundaries of the rim
mm-hmm.
to a rectangular container is a dramatic improvement.
Oh, yeah.
Container-wise for the tree and the characteristics of the material. But beyond that, there's not a lot to talk about in terms of this design, I don't think.
The cloud feet on the pot are really great.
You like those?
Yeah, I've never seen cloud feet that intricate.
Yeah. So a little bit bell-bottomy.
Oh, yeah.
You know? It's like yeah. It was like vintage cloud feet.
Sure.
Like there's a reason you haven't seen cloud feet like that much.
Like what like are
platform
cloud
shoes or something.
Yeah, what do cloud feet, what are they good for?
I mean, typically cloud feet elevate the container.
Okay.
And add height and a yep. lower contact point and more elegance to the container. These are clearly not elegant feet, which I'm not saying it's good or bad, but although interesting, they're rather, it's rather circa 1980s kind of style of ceramic.
Hey, that's back in again. 80s are back in.
I don't know how I feel about the feet on that container. I would dare to say that a more simple foot would be a lot more appropriate. But here again, too, beginning his bonsai career as a professional post-apprenticeship, and this is still that first iteration of apprentices and whatnot, who knows? I really don't know what kind of access. It wasn't the Mr. Kimura that we're looking at here. is you see the brilliance of his design work and the reconceptualization of the tree's shape, but this is a Mr. Kimura who's really starting his career as a groundbreaking bonsai artist.
Yeah.
He might not have had the plethora of pots to choose from at this point. He may not have had a lot of resources at his disposal. And this book is largely about taking material that isn't phenomenal material and applying the creativity to making it a phenomenal bonsai.
Yeah.
So some of the containers in here may have just been the best thing that he had at that time.
Sure.
Not being the famous,
not necessarily the best choice,
sort of unlimited resource that he would have later on in his career where he could go find like the pot. You know, and that's sort of what I would almost wonder or think might be happening. And also, again, I do think aesthetics are a historical marker, mm-hmm. and the aesthetics of the 1980s are quite different than the aesthetics of the current bonsai taste.
Yeah.
And more modern bonsai approach. So that's also a fascinating thing to see.
Cloud feet complement the bamboo stand pretty nicely, though.
Mm-hmm. So if you turn the page and you look at 130 or 140,
oh, there
now,
we are.
Now you start to see the design mature. And and this is a beautiful comparison to compare 140 to 139, where 139 is quite rigid. It's very symmetrical. In 140, this is only
a darker background,
too. This is only 1 year. So October of 1983 on page 139, July of 1984. So he got a whole season of growth.
Yep.
In terms of Rigida really pushing strong in the spring, being pinched, being pruned. By the time we get to this point in July, mid to late July in the summer of 1984, and now you start to see where the silhouette moves out, it pulls back in, it moves back out again, and you're moving away from that really rigid triangular form.
Yep.
Now, the rigid symmetrical triangular form, and we talked about this earlier, when you first style a piece, a raw tree, oftentimes it is symmetrical. It is very uninteresting. You're putting the branches out there to elongate, to get strength, to get length, to get thickness. And then you start getting interior budding and you start building. That's when you really start building the iterations of design. And here is a perfect example. Even in 1 year, the iteration now compared to the one in October of 1983 is already taking on a much finer form. And again, that's why it's so hard to really critically analyze some of this work, because it's so young and so fresh and the changes are dramatic from the before to the after of the first iteration. But Mr. Kimura was really a master of building trees. He knew what they were going to become with the patience. He knew that setting the structure was the primary point. The picture on page 140 in 1984, this iteration was set up by the picture on page 139 in 1983, by handling those branches and accepting the symmetry at that point, he allowed everything to develop with strength and sustainable design to photosynthesize and backbud. So he knew by having that, that wasn't what he was striving for. That was what he had to do to then get to the picture on page 140. And from that point on, it would only get better. It would only get better and more interesting and more asymmetrical.
Yeah, it looks it's quite a different tree on 140. It's a better background. 139, the trunk and dead wood gets washed out a little bit with the background, the brighter background. Whereas 140, it's more stand out. It's a formal upright. I really don't know much about formal upright. I just don't have that much experience with them, and I've always had a hard time making them look good.
Oh, a formal upright is, I think, the most challenging style in bonsai. People like to say, oh, the literati form is so challenging.
Yeah.
And it's like, it is. Like, the simplicity, and maximizing design with a minimal amount of branching and foliage. And But the formal upright is the true test.
Yeah,
without a doubt, it's the true test. Because you're playing with every single opportunity in design to generate interest in a trunk that doesn't move anywhere.
Yeah.
And that becomes really playing with positive and negative space to generate foreground, middle ground, background, length, you know, reduction of length, space, and positive mass. And it's a tricky one.
It certainly is.
It's a tricky one. Let's keep moving.
Yep, keep going. Future Bonsai Masterpieces.
142. I got to see this tree.
Wow, great.
I got to see this tree during my apprenticeship. And one of the things that happen in the cultivation of bonsai is sometimes the proportion of the first iteration or that youthful form. The youthful form itself is young, and it appears young. This is very young. Notice how mm-hmm. how sort of almost like pom-pom like the pads are.
Yep.
He's still generating the buds and the ramification to compress and streamline the formation of the pads here. But seeing this tree in 2007 or 2008.
What did it look like?
The proportion, the size of the apical region, the size and density of the branches was so overwhelming to the delicacy or the thinness of the trunk.
It had been overgrown.
Well, I mean, because when you build that first proportion, a lot of times with really delicate trees, that small, really sort of minimal, limited size of everything is actually what's appropriate for a slender trunk.
Yeah.
And then they start to grow on top of that. And with a big, heavy, masculine, mature, powerful tree, that's exactly what you want, is that expansion.
But with a feminine tree, it's like, you kind of want to go back to
you kind of want to go back
how it first looked when you first
exactly,
styled it.
Exactly. Yeah. And how do you create that age and that refinement and all of the things that you talk about in the evolution of a bonsai on a tree that really functions with sparseness and a minimal or reduced size and proportion and whatnot. And that is a tricky, tricky thing to navigate, mm-hmm. to grow a tree out that in the first styling had the right proportions but didn't have the maturity, to then gain the maturity by overgrowing the proportion and be able to pull back to that size and proportion that maximizes that elegant nuance of the material, but to do so with the level of ramification and refinement that shows sort of that test of time. That's a really, really tough thing to try and execute well. And this tree, when I saw it, it hadn't been in Mr. Kimura's hands. It was brought back to him. But when I saw it, it clearly was time to again pull it back.
Yeah.
And it's in bonsai go through that cycle.
Absolutely.
They have to overgrow their proportion to be brought back
yep.
to the proportion and advance their concept of age.
This all is part of the vortex.
This is the vortex. This is exactly sort of the journey of the tree, right?
This tree has some great differentiation between the live vein and dead wood. I like the pot. The pot's maybe a little wide for this, but it sure is a nice pot. Looks strong, looks solid for such a delicate tree, which here's a good point. The apex has broken the plane of the pot, so it really works in this way.
Yeah, I think you touched on, it's a very delicate tree, and it is a stronger pot. And again, whenever you go into like the pentahexa octagonal form of a container, you're really starting to touch on picking up nuances of masculine and feminine.
Yeah.
Because you've got the round, so the round form would be the feminine form for a design of this tree. The square form would be the masculine form for a design of this tree. Now, you don't see shallow square containers very much, mm-hmm. because to say that the shallow square container is a masculine container for this form of a tree. Well, this form of a tree is always going to be elegant.
Yep.
That's going to go into this container, right? You only see square containers as semi-cascade or cascading containers with more depth because you do have strong masculine semi-cascade and cascading trees.
Yeah.
But when you go super shallow, the shallow container is designed for a feminine form, and no longer do you have a masculine feminine tree with a shallow square container. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So this pentahexa octa is almost like a insinuating sort of a tree that would have a thicker trunk but curvaceous movement, or a thinner trunk and more angular movement. And this has a thin trunk and very curvaceous movement. I would say inside of that, a round container would be far more appreciable, or instead of the strong corners to have lobes, to have lobed, almost floral form lotus to the container. No, not a lotus. A lotus would be for an informal upright. And this definitely lends itself. Like you said, apex breaking the lateral boundary, the round form would be fine. If you were going to have any sort of asymmetrical concept to that, a floral lobed form as opposed to the angles of the pentahexa-octagonal form probably would highlight this tree even more and make it feel a little bit more delicate and ornate.
Yep.
This is a quite ornate tree.
Yep.
Yeah, this tree was really beautiful to see in person.
Is this a hemlock?
No, this is a taxus.
Taxus.
Yep. So the five-needle pine on page 143.
Yep.
This is actually quite a famous tree now. It has a little bit of history to it. It's had multiple owners. The way that it looks now is entirely different. This is a very This is a very compressed form compared to now. You can see more of the trunk line.
Okay.
The canopy is quite a bit bigger, but the defining characteristics of this tree as now a more prominent piece that has some provenance behind it is the deadwood that exists on it, which is slightly unusual for a white pine
have
that, but it is a very defining component of this particular tree.
Yeah, I love it. Hanging off the front of the pot. The pot's really heavy, but it's a very strong, very masculine composition.
Mm-hmm. And you see the square pot underneath it as a result.
Yeah.
But in the paragraph, second paragraph on the page, it says it has many possibilities, but at this time, Kimura has not yet selected a design objective. Even inside that paragraph, again, we talked about the translation, how accurate is the translation, but mm-hmm. I think that's a really strong paragraph just to say, even in the iteration that you're looking at right here and right now, it's basically a discussion that he hasn't totally committed to the future of this tree yet. He's not sure, or he's building and developing. It's not time yet to make that commitment.
And you said it's gotten taller.
It's gotten taller. I mean, because
more trunk showing.
Yeah, you're stacking years and years and years of growth, which is incremental elongation and expansion and ramification. This tree's canopy is entirely different now. Entirely different. But the trunk characteristics still create sort of a referential point to recognize that it is the same tree.
It's awesome. Next page.
144.
Flowering bonsai.
Himeshara.
What is that?
Stewardia.
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 Gorgeous. Look at that pot. Glazed bright white pot with these bright white flowers. I love it. In fact, you just sold a couple of Stewardias in the last tree sale, right?
Yeah.
It looks a little overgrown, probably why this is in the future bonsai section. Seems like you could really get in there and open up some negative spaces and sort of better define your layers. Man.
Well, so
On a flowering bonsai, sometimes you need to let that thing grow so it flowers.
Boom, there it is.
And
right?
And yeah.
You when you are growing a tree to allow it to, in the deciduous form, allow it to experience some of the seasonal aspects that give it its most value, mm-hmm. Then sometimes the shape of the tree is not as important at that moment in time as the actual thing that you're allowing it to grow unchained yeah. for. And I think the display of the flowers here is a really prominent aspect that I don't think in the documentation of Stewardia typically you see them in winter silhouette a lot, because the orangey coppery color yeah. of the trunk with in the deciduous
yep.
form, it's beautiful. But you don't see them in leaf. I mean, you can see that the coppery color of the trunk is largely takes a back seat to the canopy.
Mm-hmm.
But also in seeing them in winter form so much, I don't think a lot of people realize how beautiful the flowers of Stewardia are. And it really is. It's very, very beautiful. It's not like an ume where those flowers are occurring in the leafless form against a rugged trunk, though.
Yeah.
You have to have the foliage to have the flowers. So it's just one of these momentary points in this tree over the course of the season that could be an enjoyable moment to view and take in sort of the characteristics of the tree. But I think it's talking about the future bonsai concept from the perspective of just continuing to enhance the strong characteristics of the Nabari, which Stewardia is another species a lot like Japanese maple or trident maple, where the roots will really plate out and fuse and form a really big, strong, really fused plate-like root structure.
Okay.
And this tree, in the article, it says that Mr. Kimura, you know, cultivated the Nabari with some different techniques, and it's still very young in its development of a base that would actually kind of prove out to be a phenomenal base for a Stewardia as it's accepted in the Japanese model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great base on this one.
That's getting better. Young, but getting better.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's the whole idea of the future bonsai, it being in the future bonsai portion of the book. And 145.
Okay. Looks like a Japanese black pine.
Japanese black pine.
Super strong. Dead a little hint of dead wood in there. And then look at those plates of bark.
It was collected in an island south of Tokyo just before the Second World War. Wow.
Never. This looks like a pretty big tree.
Yeah, I've never seen this tree in person. I would love to, though. What a tremendous trunk for a Japanese black pine. Yeah, that's really impressive. Notice the Nabari on the left anchors.
Yep.
That huge movement to the right.
Yeah, it has a nice, yeah.
Pretty awesome shoot. Nice. It's in the shoes on.
Interesting roots on the left.
Yeah, a shoes on. Square container, very strong container.
Yeah.
No flare to the lip. Just a straight walled
frames.
Inset square. Really yep, beautiful. Yeah, that's quite a stunning composition, isn't it? Symmetry in the apex. So when I started thinking seriously about going to study with Mr. Kramer, I had obviously followed his work since I was 12 and
mm-hmm.
in college trying to secure an apprenticeship with him. The one thing about Mr. Kramer's work, obviously he does all this innovative work, and that's great and that's cool. And a lot of that innovative work is done with junipers. And I actually didn't spend a lot of time looking at the junipers of Mr. Kimura. I spent more time looking at the pine work that he did. And I found his pine work to be really appealing. But his concept for the black pine was that black pines really come into sort of their full state of design fruition when you get that really domed out canopy.
Mm-hmm.
And his justification for the domed out canopy is that a tree in the natural environment, when it hits its state of maturity where it can't raise resources against the force of gravity any longer, the apex starts to move laterally instead of vertically at that point. And it's a real sign of maturity in a pine to get that lateral movement and that broadening of the apical region. And the black pine is a coastal variety of pine.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have the weight of snow and elements like that acting on it. Now, obviously, you have typhoons and stuff like that and sail mm-hmm. effect. But he really broadened the apex of his pines, the black pine particularly, to a degree where you lose a lot of the directional insinuation.
Yeah. It's just an umbrella.
And since coming back and practicing bonsai as a professional on my own, I have had mixed feelings about that, because I feel like for as much effort as you put into really adding a lot of design nuance to trees in terms of their insinuation of direction and the design feel to the tree, that losing the ability to dictate the directional insinuation of the apex kind of causes an element of stagnation in the design. And that's one of the things that I see as I look at this. Yes, the trunk moves dramatically to the right. Yes, there is a clear asymmetrical branch that's reaching out farther and defining that movement. But the apex lacking that movement, almost turning back to the viewer and being centered on the design, sort of stops the completion of that concept that's already been started. And I want that directional insinuation so much. And
now, if you look closely, the tallest needles up there are slightly to the right of the apex, but it's
true. It's pretty helmet like, right?
Yes, it sure is.
And there's a strong chance that Mr. Kramura's use of the apex in the design is something that continued to evolve after this book, although there have been trees in here that have had, particularly with the junipers, and inside of the junipers, the more elegant junipers had definitive design, apical insinuation of direction. Mm-hmm. But this pine definitely doesn't. And I saw this concept applied to a lot of pines while I was studying there. And I really found that to be quite fascinating to compare the two.
Strong pine. This is